Hey, everybody, welcome to the Horse Geeks podcast, where we look at horses and riders from the inside out. I'm Kirsten Nelson, professional horse trainer, and with me is Deb Romero, certified Alexander Technique instructor. So today we wanted to shift gears just a little bit away from the truly geeky side of looking at forces of motion and body mechanics and research papers and take a little bit more of a practical, what does it feel like tone to our discussion today. So it's the practical side of making changes in our habits of movement. It's a big deal for the body to change structural coordination, muscle use, our perception of that. And then how do we do it, especially if we're working on our own? Like, what are some, you know, things we could play with if we want to make changes? So that's going to be our discussion today. And we'll review quickly just the whole relationship between the body mechanics and the forces of motion, how that interplays, just to kind of bring home why we even need to learn about it. And then mainly today, our perception of our body use, which is a really big deal in our nervous system, as well as in the horse's nervous system. So that's what we'll talk about mostly, and then bring in a few practical things we can try. So the last podcast, I think we introduced the idea of like how we perceive balance through the fluids in our inner ear, our eyes, our vestibular ocular reflex, and the proprioceptors, which are neurons throughout our entire nervous system in muscle, tendon, ligament, and joints that sort of tell us where our body is in time and space. So like with horses and riders, I have to bring into part of the training instincts. And that has a little bit of play in what we're talking about today, but the main focus is sort of on mechanics and forces of motion. So instinctually, we all learn to function. We all learn not to fall over and get things done throughout our life.
Yeah.
But when we study functional anatomy or we study what's called body mechanics, we learn that the inherent design of a body, the inherent anatomy of a living body, tells us what ideal function is versus dysfunctional coping strategies, I guess we could call it. So we get things done, but over time can create repetitive damage, like wear and tear. Sorry, I'm losing my voice. Wear and tear or small repetitive damages from minor misuses of the machine.
Exactly. Yeah. It's kind of like you don't want to use a computer or dial up. Who would go back to dial up internet?
Right. Right. Exactly.
Why aren't we, if we think we need to constantly update our electronics, shouldn't we also apply that to how we're using this mechanism, the body, our bodies? Shouldn't we be applying that same thing to ourselves? And to,
yes.
I mean, that's kind of like what we're doing with our horses, right? I mean, we're kind of asking them to perform at a certain level. And are we asking that of ourselves?
Right. And the operating system of the body, just like electronics, is electrical.
Yes.
It is the electrical system of the body that's dictating the use of the mechanics.
Yes.
So upgrading that, or just figuring out our way back to this blueprint of the machine. I would say every, you know, we're born with this sort of blueprint inherent in the design of the body. But we don't always use it according to instructions because we were never given instructions.
I didn't get any.
I know. I missed that instruction manual. So playing with the body and forces of motion in the most optimal, which just means the highest potential
at
of
that
any
moment.
Right. Yeah. The highest potential of the mechanism of the body in motion. And that varies depending on what you're doing. So like you said, in the moment.
It's in the moment.
But the benefit of sort of optimizing or upgrading the nervous system to enhance mechanical use is force management. So in other words, if you're a high level athlete, it enhances performance, increasing maybe your times, reducing the amount of effort or metabolic effort it takes to do the same job, and reducing the risk of injury or system failure.
And you would think all of us would want that.
Yeah. But a lot of times we don't even consider that it would be available. Like, it was big news to me that I could change how I moved. Like, I remember when that was like a new thought that had never occurred to me before. That I could have conscious control over my body mechanism to a much higher degree than just going to the mailbox, getting on a horse, driving a car, doing what I'm doing in life, that there were ways to go about doing that that enhanced my structural use and force management. Or I think I was doing what we all do. I'm just getting older. It's getting harder. I'm just aging, or my horse is aging. And I don't think that that's always the case.
Yeah. And there's all of that language and thought built around the age process. You know, that one of them is you get shorter. Well, that's probably because we're not in very good use. That's why we're getting shorter. So,
right.
And when you go to Alexander School for 3 years, you actually get taller. You gain 1 to 3 inches in height.
That was my experience. Just doing Alexander mm-hmm. Technique lessons, I appeared on top of a horse as if I had longer legs.
Yes.
Because I changed my use. I actually did measure about an inch taller than what's on my driver's license.
So why do you think that is? What
for me personally,
did you find out in you that made that happen?
So for me personally, I had the typical sort of female use of excessive holding an excessive curvature in my low back. So the natural lordotic curve was sort of, I just held it excessively curved, right? So learning how to straighten that curve a little bit, it not only added an inch to my height, which I found fascinating, because the height was always there, but with the bones curved, of course you're reducing your height.
Oh, good point.
Because the energy is dissipating horizontally or laterally. So you're changing your vertical height measurement, right? And then my legs appeared longer because with that sort of excessive curve in my low back, my leg muscles were constantly pulling upward. So like my hamstrings and quads were super tight all the time. Yoga was a big challenge. And I looked like I had a long torso and short legs. But as I changed the balance of my head over my neck and I changed the arrangement consciously, which was a lot of effort. Like, this isn't, even though it sounds easy, like that software program of how I was using my body was ingrained deep default.
And so didn't want to leave the building.
It's not giving it up because that's what's kept me stable all these years. Right.
Well, and you think the horses probably go through the same thing when we're asking them, say, the curve, if you see horses in extension where their backs dropped and we're asking them to change that, they could probably, like you said, be going through all the same stuff we go through.
Absolutely. And some of it had to come slowly because the release of chronic muscle tightness in my legs, which was also keeping all of my leg joints slightly more in a flexed position than extended. So my leg joints, my hip joint, my knee joint, my ankles were all sort of like a little bit excessively flexed all the time. An extension where the muscles would lengthen was a little bit uncomfortable at first.
Right.
But I wasn't consciously altering my legs. That was the really interesting part. As I changed the habit of use through my spine, the legs reflected the change. Where for years before that, I was going to yoga regularly, trying to become more limber. But then as soon as I'm out of yoga class, the use of my spine was just constantly contracting my leg joints and my leg muscles. So it was this never-ending battle, you know, and that's where I see people injure themselves is sort of going, I've got to stretch these muscles out, but the spine is not matching the limbs.
So that's a really good point that you bring up about the spine. And I know we can go back to that with horses also, if the spine of the human or the horse isn't being used properly, it affects the entire system.
Well, because it houses the central nervous system.
Right.
It houses the electrical operating system of the body. So the nervous system, the whole central nervous system dictates all movement. That's why it's the axial skeleton. Everything revolves around that. And once I learned to work with the mechanical functions of all the joints of the spine, all the bones of the spine, the head balance, right? All of that axial skeletal stuff, the limbs changed as a result.
Right. And did you know that you have more proprioceptors in your neck, your hands, and your ankles than you do anywhere else?
Really?
Yes. So when Alexander first began his exploration, he was really looking at his head-neck relationship. And, you know, most of our work is based on that key relationship, but now we know that there's more proprioceptors there that dictate how the rest of the body functions. And if you think about it with balance, the head, neck, and the ankles, your feet are on the ground. So all that information is coming up about the proprioceptive of where you are in time and space, going up your legs.
From your feet and your ground contact.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's what we talked about a little bit last time, was sort of that feedback loop from the bottoms of our feet up into our vestibular ocular reflex. It's like that feedback loop.
And it's constantly going into the central nervous system. And there's a thing called the Golgi tendon response, which is right at where your tendon attaches, that tells the body, is it too long? Is it too short? Are we holding it too long? And if we effort to try to balance and we lock, like you said, you used to lock your legs, that shuts down those proprioceptors and makes the muscles shorten even more. So we've lost more mobility by efforting to try to do the balancing.
Right. And that kind of leads us into, you know, how do we initiate changes? What's our experience internally when we start to work on changing the use of our body or managing forces in a different way, which is directly related to the mechanical use of our body? And the proprioception, like before I did Alexander work or got into this vein of riding, working on the horse's balance, I had no idea. I just looked at my body and go, that's my confirmation. I have a long torso and short legs and I'm 5'4". That's my confirmation, and never thought of it as being unchangeable. Yeah. And then as being introduced to this work on body mechanics and looking at force management, it was so disorienting to make some of those changes because, like you're saying, I had shut off certain proprioception in my body and my nervous system, the powerful human brain can normalize anything, right? So I came up as a jump rider and I thought I kind of have a jockey body. And then I look at myself more in more recent pictures of riding, and I'm like, when did I grow legs? When did my torso look more proportional to my legs? And you would think of that as confirmation that that's just our body shape. And yet I experienced a huge change and saw a huge change in my own body. And working with horses, it's no different. But the disruption to the nervous system in that process was incredible, because you don't know what you don't know.
Exactly.
You don't know what you're completely unaware of. And so I remember at first, like, really needing visual feedback. And as a teacher working with rider balance, thank God for smartphones, because now I can take video and photos instantly, because what it looks like isn't what it feels like at first.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I didn't feel messing with that whole vestibular eye ear coordination of changing that.
Right. And by straightening my back, I would have thought I instantly felt taller, but my first experience of consciously controlling the curve in my low back was I felt wider, which was an interesting experience. And as I straightened my low back, I also felt kind of like Quasimodo. I felt very hunchy compared to my usual stand up straight posture, which involved overarching my low back and sort of thrusting my shoulders back, lifting the sternum. That was where my brain said I was straight. Right. So as I actually just sort of relaxed the shoulders and straightened the low back, I felt suddenly a foot wider, which was a really weird sensation. And I felt very slumpy. So I'm like, oh my God, this instructor is making me walk like a dwarf or an Oompa Loompa. Right. And so looking in a full view mirror or full length mirror, and looking at photographs or video, it's shocking. It's sort of shocking because then the eye takes it in, but there's a big adaptation period when you're upgrading the nervous system, just like an upgrade on your operating system on your computer. Sometimes it throws the system into a little bit of glitchiness and chaos, and you have to keep rebooting it to get it to run smoother. And that was what I felt like. I'm rebooting. And in that process, feeling a little bit less coordinated.
Yeah.
Before I found something better, it was just disrupting what was normal.
I remember that in Alexander School, I think it was after my first year, and another person that was going through school with me, she was a soccer player. Both of us, I pretty much eliminated riding. She stopped playing soccer because our bodies had learned a new coordination, but we didn't know how to function with that new coordination in our old activity.
Yes.
Because our brain wanted to go back to the bad habits, but the new part of me was going, well, no, you can't ride like that.
Right. So like what you talked about last time is the nervous system, when we learn something, like as toddlers, we go from crawling to walking, we're building the software program that we call walking. Right. And we can even mimic our parents as part of that movement development.
Big thing. Yeah.
Right. And so that software program, to be a highly efficient and functioning human, you rely on those software programs.
Yes.
So we can also have software programs like you're describing called riding that are based on
exactly how
you first learned to ride, or playing soccer, how you first learned to play soccer, or for
just
horses.
Get it done.
Yeah. With the horses, it's just like even as simple as walk, trot, canter on a circle. All of a sudden, when you're changing the internal mechanical use into a different, aiming for a more optimal coordination, more optimal use, you still have all this disruption. So I see the horses get a bit stumbly. I have to keep the work really simple while they're going through these coordination changes and give them time to not do their usual performance work until the body has stabilized in a new use.
Yes.
And that's what you're saying you found with riding while you were going through the Alexander School.
Yes. Just like you were saying, going slow, just walking and talking and eating and driving were big things.
Big challenges. So now that you're on the other side of that and you've come back to riding with these changes in your body that you gave yourself the time to adapt,
yes.
How has it changed your riding?
Like
what's different now about riding from years before you worked on yourself?
Good question. I think some of the things you brought up about before Alexander and after, I used to think I needed to use a lot of effort and muscular contraction to achieve anything, where I found it to be quite the opposite. The less efforting, the more I stay open and available in all my joints, the easier it is.
The easier it is for you to balance, or has it had an effect on your horse?
Definitely had an effect on my horse. If I focus more on my own true balance over a moving object, it becomes a smoother relationship.
Yeah, because you become a stable factor, right, on a moving force, which is, it just inherently means it's going to be easier for the horse.
Right. It might not feel it at the beginning, but because the horse is probably, I have not ridden that I know of a horse that's in balance. And that's a good point, where balance isn't a place. It's not static. It's not stillness. It's the opposite.
Have you met a human with perfect function?
No.
No. It doesn't exist. We have a theoretical ideal that we improve ourselves towards to kind of tap into potential. So
exactly.
We become more athletic, we become healthier, but nobody ever achieves this perfect state because life is always moving. Forces are always interacting. Life, it's just always at play. But it does feel easier and more efficient. And I get better performance out of my horse the more I work on myself.
I completely agree. Completely agree.
Because then I also have more accurate, I think you were saying last time, if our balance, if we're working hard to stay in a dysfunctional use of our body, we're shutting off our ability to sense the subtle forces in changes of direction and changes in magnitude that are being generated by the horse. So we don't know how to guide the horse. We don't know how to fix the problem because we don't really know which way the forces are going all the time.
Right. Information is not getting to the brain whatsoever.
Right. It's not coming into our body. And I think you said something else about the instruction we use. There is a paper you and I had talked about. Oh. Do you have it?
Yeah, the Lighten Up paper.
Yes.
Postural instructions affect static and dynamic balance. And what it comes down to say is thinking of upright posture as effortless, reduced muscle activation and improved balance, while thinking of upright posture as effortful made balance worse.
So just how we think about it, how difficult it is or how easy it is, kind of guides us a little bit, because correct mechanical use, something in the direction of optimal, according to the design, always feels easier. Balance just describes an equalization of all the factors that are all these dualistic and multiple factors that are at play. Balance is that still point within it. So it makes sense that as we feel more ease, we're improving our balance.
Yeah. And if a lot of times working with older adults, there's all these exercises and things you can do, or a scale standing on one leg for a certain length of time gives the longer you stand, the more longevity you have. I don't know what it was.
It's actually that they measure people's age very accurately by how long you can stand on one foot. That's an accurate measure of age.
That just blows my mind.
In a blind study.
Because I was reading some of Walter Carrington's work, who he's a first generation Alexander teacher, about what happens when fear comes into your brain that you're going to fall and how that affects your ability to balance.
Absolutely. That's the instinct part.
Yeah.
And certain our instinctual posture, which is extension. I think in humans, we call it startle. It's that sort of arching of the back, thrusting the torso forward, head back. That startle instinct, the horses have one and we have one, mm-hmm. is one of the most dysfunctional uses long-term of the body. So why do we have that? Well, we have that because in order to save our bacon with fight or flight, what happens is the muscles take over,
right.
and the chemicals that are pumped into the body, adrenaline, all of the stress hormones, right? Cortisol, adrenaline, norepinephrine, all of that is chemically and muscularly giving us temporary strength for fight or flight. But if we stay there over the long term, it taxes the muscles, it stresses the hormone system, which and all the bodily functions related mm-hmm. to it, and it actually has a destabilizing effect on the axial skeleton, on the spine.
Yes, because the more we effort and use muscular tension, the less mobile we are. There's no availability. There's no mobility left if you lock everything.
Right, which is why my legs got longer.
Yeah.
When I just simply, the body started to relax chronic patterns of muscle holding and joint flexion. Mm-hmm. And my legs visibly looked longer. Now, the process of that isn't, even though ultimately you find the ease of better use of the body, the initial disruption is, it's catastrophic to the nervous system. And I finally realized when I was working with riders and horse balance, there was always a point with a new client where they would look at me and sort of ask me for my credentials and my background. And I realized that's the moment that they're feeling so disrupted that their brain is screaming, this can't be right. This can't be right. And as an Alexander student going through the same thing, what I learned were different strategies to sort of ease people through that disruption, because there is disruption. And I got to say, especially if people are working on their own, or what I did a lot for myself was pictures, video, full-length mirrors, things where we can see ourselves and play with different uses of our body.
I think that's a really good point that you bring up, is the play, the creativity and adaptability and play. Because if the thoughts in our head come up, oh, is this right or wrong, or fear, you have shut down that adaptability, play,
curiosity
side of you. And that's what you need to be thinking, like that child that is trying to get up and walk, you know, that curiosity to go after. In Alexander school, we called it to go find the jewel. You know, that's what kids want to do. They see something and they're like, oh, I've got to have that. So they're going to figure out their locomotion no matter what.
Yeah, they're not embarrassed when they fail. I should say we're not. We were all children. We're not embarrassed when we fail.
But as we get older, those thoughts coming in, those are the things we really need to start interrupting. That pattern is...
Well, and what I find is our body remains childlike or animal-like, in that the proprioception in our nervous system actually has a boatload of information, it's a better source of information for our moving mechanical use or our relationship to gravity than our brains. Our brains, especially as we age, are so strong in those software programs.
Yes.
That it sort of chokes when we go to reboot this or upgrade the software program. But the body is a wealth of information. That's where we actually, everybody, even if the brain is sort of screaming otherwise, our body has this information where it feels easier. It doesn't mean our brain is going to agree at first.
Exactly.
Our brain might scream. But some of the tricks I use are, there's a huge difference in our awareness and focus when we shift between our focal vision and our peripheral vision.
Yes.
So as a predator species, when we go into our focal vision, if we're focused on what the horse is doing more than what we're doing as riders, we leave our bodies. We become unaware of that proprioception or what we're feeling, because a predator on focal vision is going after something. Like you're saying, there's the jewel. Yep. Now we just let our body arrange on the path to getting it,
yes.
Right? Where peripheral vision, and I think in Sally Swift's classical book, Centered Riding, she talks about soft eyes.
Yes, she does.
That just means go into the peripheral vision. And for some reason, purposefully not looking at anything in particular, not using the focal vision and purposefully using the peripheral vision, everybody's awareness instantly shifts internally.
Yes. It's like driving. You don't look at the hood of the car when you drive.
Right.
Or at the steering wheel.
Right. And it's it's an interesting perspective to go, how far down the road am I looking?
Exactly.
Right. And sometimes the farther the focal point, or taking in everything around you while you're driving, you can still keep your eyes on the road and notice peripherally what's happening on the sides of the road. Right. And that sort of connects the internal experience to the external experience.
And that's what the horse is doing, aren't they? They're horses. Peripheral.
Well, yeah. When we reviewed that Umwelt paper, it's interesting that their vision is primarily peripheral vision. They have very little focal vision, but they have a stronger sense of sensitivity to movement, which is peripheral vision.
The plastic bag.
A plastic bag, or the bushes shaking, or on a windy day.
The neighbor over there.
Right. A windy day, a horse can easily become overstimulated because there's so much movement in the peripheral vision.
And I would think, we've probably talked about this in other podcasts, that if they are not biomechanically in a good place, that fight or flight's going to fire up much sooner than later. Or startle, whatever you want to call it. The same thing happens in a human. I mean, the less we are optimal, the more
sensitive we become to potential danger.
Exactly.
And that keeps us on alert, which kind of keeps us in that, sympathetic nervous system, that not awareness of the use of our body, because it's the same with horses. Horses that have behavioral issues always have a certain level of instability in the body or poor function. It's directly related. So horses that tend to be chronically spooky or sensitive, or people even call them ADD, it's like they're just hyper alert to danger because they don't feel secure and strong in their own bodies. So they need more time to get away from a potential predator, right?
Yeah, and I think you mentioned that about, they can't be perceived as that, or they're the next one in line to get eaten by the lion,
Well, that's why they hide mechanical lameness.
Right.
So they can mask it for so long, but the body is aware of feeling unstable or unsafe or exhausted.
Exactly.
So the body feeds the brain to become more fearful and be on high alert because it knows it's weakening. And so what's interesting is one of the safety techniques I use with a horse that's kind of not so safe to ride is pulling that horse's focus into internal operations, right? So playing with the horse's body the same way an Alexander instructor kind of works with a human body. Mm-hmm. As soon as I start guiding the body even a little bit towards a better use of the spine, better mechanics, it instantly gets the horse's attention because nothing is more important to a body than how they're moving. So yes. People might watch me in an arena doing something really boring and thinking my horse would be bored to tears, blah, blah, blah. But when you bring that focus internally, there's nothing boring about it. It's challenging, it's intense, it's complicated, but it's all happening invisibly between the horse and the rider. And for a lot of riders, I'll say, when I work with their balance, either on or off the horse, all of a sudden there's this epiphany of going, oh, this is what my horse is going through. This is how it fries the brain. This is why it doesn't look hard, but it feels hard. And the hard right. part, I've got to say, I have to bring this to people's attention because the brain kind of overrides, but I go changing the body when I'm rebooting or my own nervous system or helping somebody change their balance, I call it rebooting because we have to go to the physical use where the brain is happy and then explore and be curious about this new use without giving it a value judgment immediately.
Exactly.
So I go, you go back and forth, you make the brain happy, you listen to the body. You make the brain happy, you listen to the brain's opinion, you listen to the body's opinion. And it's like the little angel and devil on your shoulder, right? But as we go back and forth, it's like that innate body intelligence always bubbles up. It's always there just under the surface when I bring people's awareness to it. I don't care how old they are, how many injuries they've had, what their life experience has been. It's like that proprioception in our nervous system is available our entire life. It doesn't go away. Yes. It doesn't change. Right. And getting the brain and the body to agree is the only part I'm guiding people to do is listen and be curious, or I'm giving them techniques like, close your eyes. Especially if I'm leading the horse from the ground, I go, can you balance in the saddle with your eyes closed? Closing your eyes completely, all of a sudden, your focus is 100% internal.
You quote unquote hear better.
Yes.
Kinesthetically, because when you take away the eyes, which unfortunately with the Industrial Revolution has become a big deal for us, is the use of the eyes. That takes us away from our kinesthesia and proprioception. That's a big deal.
I think also while we're in school or if we work for a living at a desk job, we just gradually sort of quit listening to our body.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Because most of our survival is in what we think and how we use our brain. That's part of human evolution, is that it's more and more your survival is based on mentality more than it is your physical strength or your physical use.
Right. Yeah.
So a lot of
Alexander said was the fall of the human being was the Industrial Revolution.
Because we don't have to move as much. We don't have to function physically.
The activity is repetitive.
That
Whereas,
too.
Yeah. When we're doing farm work and things like that, it wasn't the same thing every day. We were using our bodies differently.
Right. Right. No,
and
even
we didn't have that little time thing on our wrist, you know,
right.
All of those things factor into our use.
Yes, absolutely. So what are there some of the practical things for anybody who's listened this long? You get a bonus. Here's what you can do at home for practical things. Number one is play with doing normal tasks with your eyes closed when it's safe to do so.
I'm glad you made that point.
Right? When it's safe to do something simple and you set yourself up for success. But even moments, if you can't close your eyes, also experiencing purposefully going to your peripheral vision and doing simple jobs in your peripheral vision and catching yourself. How often do I use my focal vision?
Yeah. Or if, you know, closing your eyes is difficult, put something over your ears, plug your ears.
Yes.
Turn out the sounds, see how you do.
Absolutely. Or you can play with music. I go, I'll listen to music a lot walking through airports. And I start to become aware of how I'm moving because the music is so rhythmical and constant. So I'll start to notice how I'm walking while I'm listening to music and maybe even walk to the rhythm of the music. And I was wondering, I think plugging your ears, because even though it's a fluid response in our inner ear that tells us it's part of the vestibular balance, I wonder if plugging the ears changes the balance.
Yeah, I'd like to play with that. And another really good one, which I've been working on a lot because I had that really bad accident a year ago and had my feet crushed, is the ankles, working with the proprioceptors, say that, because what we do now is we live in a world where everything's cement, flat, and we have shoes. So experimenting with walking barefoot on different surfaces, carpeting, different shoes, somebody else's shoes, go outside at the beach, walking in the sand, you know, that's hugely different. Right. And you get a lot more information.
Well, and dry sand, wet sand, firm footing, soft footing, all of that is going to challenge the mobility of the ankle and how we use our spine. Yeah. So between sort of what you're saying, the proprioception in the neck and the proprioception in the feet, and just being curious, like, what is that? What is
maybe
that?
We should all walk barefoot in our arenas. I don't know.
Sort of the obsession over footing with high-level riders is for that very reason.
Exactly.
But I find training in a variety of footings actually enhances the strength of the back muscles, actually enhances all the muscular and skeletal coordination of the back or the spine, because the body has to adapt to these different surfaces.
And that's the name of the game. It's that adaptability and fluidity and mobility that give you balance.
Right. And that static point of stillness, whether we're talking about it mechanically or just forces of motion or in motion or how we move, that is available no matter the external environment. But we have to find the same place in a different way when we're in a different context.
Yeah, Walter Carrington said balance comes from a place of calmness.
Mm. You would have to be, because you wouldn't, if as soon as you're in instinct or you're just not thinking as an adult, if we're not consciously aware, we have to know we're running our default programs.
No kidding. Yeah.
Right. So when we want to change, and it gives riders a ton of sympathy for the process that their horses are going through, when we ourselves take this journey of going, you know, looking at visual feedback, closing our eyes, changing our vision, monkeying around with the use of our spine, ankles, neck, hands, all of that, even in daily familiar activities.
Yes.
It's like all of a sudden you realize that, and I have to point this out a lot to people, physically, it feels easier. Mentally, it feels harder. It's exhausting to the brain.
Helmet and
it
takes, fire.
Yeah, helmet fire. That's what I call it, a helmet fire. Because all of a sudden the brain is exploding, like you're studying for, organic chemistry. It's like, it's just that intense, right? But the body is going, yes, 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 this is easier, this is easier. So we recognize the ease only through the body intelligence, But the brain is going, software updates suck. No, this is not easier. This is harder. I'm lost.
I'm lost.
It can even
angry,
feel.
I'm all of those.
Yeah.
All of those emotions are going to come up.
Or fearful and vulnerable, because all of a sudden we have this sensation that we don't even know ourselves. Like the sense of self gets challenged when you change the actual mechanical function of the body, because all of a sudden you're like, where am I in time and space? I thought I had that nailed, and now it's in chaos. And so the brain really objects. But that simple technique of sort of going back and forth, honor the brain, listen to what it has to say. It's there to protect you. It's
don't
gotten you this,
it.
It's gotten you this far. So it has some good information. And there's no right or wrong way to do it. So just refrain from judgment and listen to the brain's feedback. And then refrain from judgment, stay curious and listen to the body feedback.
Yeah,
and what's so interesting is in a very relatively short period of time, I'm talking 10 minutes, usual is 10 minutes, maybe on the short side, 5 minutes, on the long side, 30 minutes, but we can reboot our nervous system into a new habit that fast and feel okay about it. Our brain and our body can agree on this new use within a time frame of 10 to 30 minutes.
Yes.
I go, that's how fast our nervous system can adapt. But then when we're not consciously aware of it at first, it just goes back to default.
Exactly.
So what's difficult, what people find hard, including myself, is sort of constantly tuning in that awareness during daily tasks, things I take for granted, and go, how am I organizing my mechanical system to do this thing I think I already know how to do?
Yeah. That's why I can't go anywhere and watch anybody eat, drink. Like, oh no, don't do it that way.
The posture police have arrived.
The posture police are here. But that's a cool thing. If people get anything from this podcast, is start looking at those things we do repetitively, daily. It doesn't have to be big tasks. It can be eating, drinking, brushing our teeth.
Getting on the horse, getting off the horse, how we sit in the saddle, how we take our reins, how we steer the horse, how we ask for an upward transition, how we ask for a downward transition. All of those have a force, laws of motion, force reality, and a mechanical use reality. So it's not that we all, as riders who have learned the skill of not falling off a horse, it's not that we can't do it. Mm-hmm. But to go to the next level of riding, it's more important how we do it. Yeah. How we manage the forces of motion, how we organize our mechanical structure during motion, and the same for the horse. If we want to advance the horse's potential, it's the same thing for the horse.
Exactly.
So I think that's a good place to wrap it up. And do you want to recap, or you want me to recap?
Go ahead.
Okay. So today's title topic is the practical side of improving balance, sort of understanding the theory from all of our geeky podcasts and research. But then what does it feel like? How do we go through it? Right. And every human, we all experience that the same way. And horses experience it the same as every other horse, but also not so different from our experience of changing mechanical functions, force management, to something that is ultimately better, but very disruptive at first.
Yes, to the brain.
Very disruptive. Yeah. So some practical things to do are stand in front of a full-length mirror, sit up and down out of a chair in front of a mirror, see what you look like.
Or take a video so you can get a perspective,
right?
A different perspective of yourself. It's kind of like listening to yourself on a recorded message. You say, I don't talk like that. I don't sound like that.
Yeah. Is that my voice?
Is
it doesn't
me?
Sound like that on the inside.
It
sounds different when I play it back. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And so playing with focal vision, peripheral vision, mm-hmm. closing your eyes, because that's a huge part of our sense of balance and stability, using any kind of visual feedback, video, pictures, yeah. mirrors, all of that helps us look at ourselves from a new perspective.
Yes.
And then yeah. recognizing, being prepared, I think, being prepared for the chaos, for the brain screaming, it doesn't want to change, knowing that that's normal and yes. that's what happens to everybody, and being gentle, being curious and gentle about change.
Yes.
That it's easier. And I actually had an interesting story with a student just last week. We've been rehabbing her horse, who was a dressage horse. She's an upper level rider. And we've just been having to go back to basics to change the habits of movement in this mare to get her over some lameness and back into some performance work. And she asked me a bunch of questions. I couldn't quite tell where she was going. And then I realized behind her questions was the thought that, when do I get to the hard part? Like, she was asking me, how is this basic stuff related to the performance stuff?
Oh,
and,
okay.
and when do we start working on performance? And in my mind, I'm going, we're working on it right now. Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't change, even though we're at a lower, even though we're doing simpler work. I wouldn't even say a lower level. It's quite high level work to change the
yes.
body. But we're doing simpler work versus complex maneuvers for performance. And so she is sort of questioning me, going, when do we get to the hard part? And I was like, wow, I never thought to say it this way. Performance isn't hard.
No.
And that comes back to what you were saying from that paper about our how we perceive the instructions or the level of difficulty. That I've ridden high performance maneuvers on a horse that felt incredibly easy because they were in good mechanical use and balanced. So I go, it's not hard to do, it's athletically, physically demanding of the body, muscular strength, metabolic use, you know, heart digestion, all of that. I go, okay, it's a positive stress though, when the body is prepared for it.
I like that, a positive stress. Yes.
Yes. Versus the hard part of sort of using your aids to cajole the body into a frame or a maneuver, it does feel hard because the body isn't prepared and we expect it to be difficult, right?
Yeah.
So it perpetuates the idea that high level work should feel difficult. And it was, I had kind of forgotten that until this student brought it up, asking me, when do we get to the hard part? When are we going to start working on performance? And I'm like, we're already there. She goes, no, but the trot feels easier than ever. And I said, and that's what it should feel like during performance.
Yes.
So we're already working on it. And it blew her mind to think that performance level work could feel as easy as the simple work that we're doing right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I go,
isn't that what those upper level human athletes do? Is they go to these special places and have all this electrodes put on them so they can slow it down and really look inside on what's going on in their body.
Yes.
To get peak performance.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And
so
then
we can
it's
do
a,
that too.
And then when you're competing, it's a positive stress on the body. So there's a certain level we could say of difficulty, but it's really just advancing the strength and metabolism of the body to do more complex work versus simple work. But if the simple work is dysfunctional, there's no amount of fixing
there's
it
no way you're
in more
get
complicated
to the
work.
The difficult's going to be even more difficult or impossible.
Yeah. Or it will create functional damage.
Yes.
Yeah. Or horses, because they're more instinctual, will just tell you, I'm not doing that. And then we call it a behavioral problem.
In very different ways.
Yes. Yes. So let's wrap it up there. But thanks for joining us, everybody. We really appreciate you listening to the podcast, liking, subscribing, sharing, all of that. And we hope you continue to join us.
Be kind, everyone.
Bye for now.